the dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. The first voice you heard was my wife, who was singing with Ella Fitzgerald's favorite guitarist, Joe Pass. And the second voice you heard was that of my friend Francis Sinatra when he was hosting The Tonight Show and had me on as his first guest. This voice is that of John Barber on John Barber's World. And the next voice that you will hear very, very soon is the voice of the brightest man in America. And I feel especially pleased right now because I really like it when I have something good to tell you. And right now I have two exceptional things to tell you about. First, of course, is my guest, who I said is the brightest man in America, which you'll discover for yourself. The second, very quickly, is a movie. As a film critic for 10 years with Los Angeles Magazine and 5 at NBC Burbank, I always said movies were like people. 99 out of 100 were really disappointing. But then that one would come along that would make up for all of the others. Very good films are very hard to find. And this one is even harder to find. Here in Las Vegas, it is only playing in one theater with only 4 late screenings. It's called The Water Diviner, an Australian film starring and directed by Russell Crowe, co-starring Olga Kurylenko, written by Andrew Knight and Andrew Anastasios. I never forget the writers. If you've happened to have read a couple of negative reviews of The Water Diviner, ignore them, especially the two from the New York Times and an outfit called Rotten Tomatoes. These were two of the outfits that raved about American Sniper, an absolutely appalling plastic recruitment poster in which Clint Eastwood did not have the guts or the storytelling talent to even tell the end of the story, in which Chris Kyle gets his own head blown off by a disturbed Iraqi vet. This ending might have given the film some purpose to show that war, especially this one, was senseless and insane. So the New York Times and Rotten Tomatoes bashing The Water Diviner is like vegetarians telling you not to eat filet mignon. It is one of the best love stories you'll ever see. And it doesn't start out as a love story for someone living, but for the dead. Russell Crowe, a farmer who has the ability to find water in the vast desert of his farm, has lost his 3 sons in the Battle of Gallipoli in 1915 in Turkey. His wife, deranged and depressed by their loss, drowns herself in one of those wells. His sole purpose now in life is to somehow get to the barren battlefields of Gallipoli, where he is not allowed to travel, to find his son's bones and bury them next to their mother. So he sets off, and what turns out to be a much more satisfying adventure film than even Raiders of the Lost Ark. So you set off to find The Water Diviner, because believe me, you'll enjoy it to the bones. And now, my guest. To me, the indestructible Mount Rushmore of American writers, by far the brightest writer activist in America. He's an extremely popular columnist for Truth Dig, one of the most recent solid essays being The Pathology of the Rich White Family. He's authored a dozen must-read books, 4 of which are my favorite: American Fascists, the Christian right and the war in America, death of the liberal class, and with cartoonist Joe Sacco, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, and my favorite, The World as It Is. He received a Pulitzer Prize of the New York Times reporting on the war on terror. He was this country's and that paper's best foreign correspondent for 15 years until they told him to stop speaking out about the war in Iraq, and luckily for us, he did not. His lectures at universities are standing room only. The very greatest history lesson I ever had was the first 15 minutes of a gripping speech he gave at a Canadian university, in which he explained with factual clarity how and why America descended into this sinkhole of a society over a period of 115 years, and I've posted it often. He is the brightest light at the end of America's very dark and lengthening tunnel, illuminating it better than anyone. So here, direct from C-SPAN on Saturday, talking about his most recent book, Wages of Rebellion, ladies and gentlemen, the real voice of America, Chris Hedges. Chris, welcome to the show, and thank you so, so much for being here.
Well, thank you, and thank you for that very generous introduction.
And I must urge you, since I know your wife, I think because now you're in San Diego, probably doing a lecture and part of the new book tour, I wonder how many hours a day do you spend at the typewriter?
A lot.
Do you ever get to see a film? And since your wife is an actress, I must urge you to go see, take your wife and the four children to The Water Diviner. It is a fabulous love story with not one kiss between a man and a woman. You will love it. Your children will love it. And so I urge you to do that. Anyway, let's get to a question that I'm sure you've had to answer a dozen times today. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I guarantee you've probably had a dozen calls from very important news folks asking you your thoughts on what happened yesterday in the Senate when Rand seemed to put up a halt for at least a couple of days on the Patriot Act.
Well, the libertarians are good on this issue, and they're good on empire, and we converge on those issues. We differ on some others. But the fact that all of our elected officials are not standing up and demanding a halt to wholesale government surveillance of the entire citizenry, and of course, let's not forget, they're included in that. And Pelosi, I think, made an allusion to that when she said something about how the CIA played tough, remember, over the torture report. We can't use the word liberty when we're watched 24 hours a day by our government. That's the relationship of a master and a slave. And you never want government to accrue to itself that kind of power because they'll use it. So it's an absolutely vital issue. The libertarians and Rand Paul have been very good on it. Unfortunately, most of the rest of the political establishment, with some exceptions like former Senator Udall, have not.
I read an article today in a really interesting daily newsletter called News Vandal, in which the author seemed to come to the conclusion that this was only a stopgap measure for two or three days, and the Patriot Act would be in full bloom again by next week.
Yes, and I think my understanding is they also have lots of end runs around it. I don't get a sense that this is going to seriously impede the wholesale surveillance that is now cemented into place within our intelligence community. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't sense that's the case.
This gets to the point of your book, Wages of Rebellion. I really enjoyed your appearance on C-SPAN on Sunday, and I was immensely impressed by the quality of the calls and the questions that they posed to you and your ability to answer them so articulately. And this is, have you ever heard of a book called National Security and Double Government?
No.
Well, there was an article published in the Boston Globe a year ago, which now seems to be, for some reason, since yesterday, making the rounds on the internet. And I was surprised to see this article in the Boston Globe. It was written by a fellow by the name of Jordan Smith, and he was reporting on this book written by a Tufts University political professor. His name is Michael Glennon. And it was called The National Security and Double Government. And he said quite openly that the reason that Barack Obama was elected is that he promised change that we can believe in. But what this professor states, and quite openly and surprisingly, it was like on the front page of the Boston Globe, was that no matter who is in the White House, who is sitting in the Oval Office, the President of the United States does not have the ability to even change foreign policy, let alone domestic policy, because the country was actually run by the national security apparatus. Do you believe that's true?
I think the national security apparatus is unassailable and can do whatever it wants. But I think corporations, and we see it with the trade agreements, the TPP and the CAFTA, and of course these corporations are now fused intimately with the national security apparatus. Of our 16 intelligence agencies, 70% of all of that work is outsourced to corporations like Bose, Allen Hamilton, and others. So, you know, there is no differentiation anymore between for-profit global corporations and the national security apparatus. So I think as long as we're aware that that national security apparatus is in essence not only working on behalf of corporate power, but is often directly controlled by corporate power, then yes.
When Eisenhower left office, he warned us, when he probably could have done something, but he didn't. He warned us, as you well know, about the military-industrial complex and its growing power. There seem to be some in the country who believe that the military-industrial complex is in second place when it comes to running the country. And I get that impression when I hear you or Ralph Nader talking about the corporatocracy that seems to be running the country. Do you think that's true, that they are now in second place?
Yeah, I think the corporatocracy is preeminent. But I think the dividing lines between the security and surveillance state and corporations has been largely erased. So, for instance, during the Occupy movement in New York, we became aware that there was a joint command center set up below Manhattan, below Wall Street, that was being staffed by corporate security, who are often hired out of the security and surveillance apparatus. And the NYPD. I don't think there's much distinction anymore. And so, yes, I think ultimately what's preeminent is corporate power. And that's because the lines have been erased between the national security apparatus and corporate power.
You spoke really passionately about the history of successful revolts in the world. And if corporations have taken over Americans, six corporations own about 90% of all the media that we see and hear and read, how would it be possible for a minority, even though it was a minority that fought the American Revolution, it was not a minority, Chris, without bloodshed.
Mm-hmm.
How would you expect this country to regain its constitution and the life that we all dreamt about without some kind of hostilities that lead to bloodshed?
Because what happened in the American Revolution replicates a struggle against a foreign occupier, a colonial occupier. And those are almost always, of course, pledged. Now, remember the British, which essentially was the equivalent of America today, was the major imperial power, and sent one of the largest armadas ever formed to besiege New York. So you had troops, largely Prussians, but you had troops coming from across the Atlantic in order to put down a native rebellion. So that's a little different. We call it a revolution, but revolutions tend to be internal. Well, revolutions always are internal affairs, so that would be the Russian Revolution or the French Revolution. And I think revolutions are almost always nonviolent in this sense, and the major theorists of revolution, Davies and Crane Brinton and others, make this point that no revolution is finally successful until large portions of the security, the internal security, defect, or at least refuse to fight on behalf of a discredited, isolated elite that is in power. This was certainly true in the Russian Revolution, so there were bread riots in Petrograd. The Cossacks, which were the Tsar's enforcers, were sent to crush those riots. They refused. They fraternized with the crowd. The Tsar is rushed back from the front and ends up abdicating in a railway carriage on a railway siding. I saw it in East Germany. So Erich Honecker, the communist dictator, in the fall of 1989, sends down an elite paratroop division to Leipzig to fire on the crowds of protesters in the city. The paratroopers refuse. Honecker is out within a week. You saw it in the Shah. As soon as the Shah fled the country and the armed forces were no longer to defend, willing to defend the regime, it collapsed. Same was true in Nicaragua with Somoza. So while we talk about the American Revolution, it's not a classical case of a revolution. It was throwing off a foreign power. And in colonial struggles, they are usually violent. Revolutions, I think, are, while certainly violence is often a part of revolution, and the anarchist violence in Tsarist Russia was common, I mean, even to the point of assassinating Tsar Alexander II and the Prime Minister Stolypin and others.
But the Cuban Revolution was not fought against invading foreigners. It was fought against Batista. That was started by Castro and 12 guys in a rowboat, for crying out loud, and gained the internal support of farmers in the country. Now, Batista may have been controlled by the CIA, and Havana may have been controlled by the mafia. And, you know, when Castro started out, I don't know if you remember this, but he was heralded as a folk hero, like Viva Zapata. He went to New York, was on the Today Show, was on the Jack Parr Show. Do you recall that?
I know it. I was a little young to recall it, but
recall it well because Jack Parr was my favorite late night host, and only he would have people like that on the show. And what turned Castro into a communist? And you well know probably from your research, you could not grow a potato in Cuba unless you got the permission of the King brothers in Texas. And when the revolution was successful and Castro took power, he said, now we have to create industry, and you create industry with oil. So the Americans offered him oil at about $2 a barrel, and the Russians offered it at $1 a barrel. So being a businessman, he took the Russian oil, and the Americans refused to refine it in Havana. And what Castro did, he confiscated their properties. He then became, in the eyes of America and the press, a communist, but he repaid the oil company owners every cent of what they claimed the property was worth in their income tax returns, as he did with the King brothers. So that's when he became a communist, when he was trying to develop his own society. He had not fought as a communist. He had fought as a socialist. Now we have a socialist, Bernie Sanders, who says if he is not getting the nomination, he's supporting the Democratic nominee.
Right.
Chris, how can you possibly have change in a society when there is absolutely no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats, and people like Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders just refused to start a third party?
Well, this was, of course, Sanders' mistake, because on a couple levels. First of all, the Democratic Party is part of the problem. It is, as has been captured by corporate interests, as has the Republican Party. And so he won't be critiquing the Democratic Party. He also will not get on the debates unless he agrees to endorse the candidate, who it appears will be Hillary Clinton. And what happens is that in April, he's out of the election, and he's funneled money and energy into a Democratic system and functions as a kind of sheepdog in the way Van Jones functioned in the last election, to channel all of that back into a system we should be trying to dismantle. But let me just go back to the Cuban Revolution just to make the point. Castro's forces were pretty meager, and I think what brought down the regime were the general strikes and the protests. And because Castro had a small armed group, he was able to, of course, capitalize it. Remember, they got on their trucks and they sped into Havana. But I think even in the Cuban Revolution, ultimately, because Batista fled the country in the same way the Shah did, and as soon as he fled, the will to protect the regime disintegrated. So I think it does make Davies and Brinton's point again, that as soon as the security apparatus refuses to protect the regime, it's finished. So I think that was also true in the Cuban Revolution.
Okay, I have a couple of other pertinent questions I think to ask you, but we have a caller named John, and since he is from Canada, and I plug the fact that you speak often at Canadian universities, John, if you're on line one, you have a question for Chris. Go ahead.
Yes, hello, Chris. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you so much for being here. I want to first make a comment and just say your interviews with Sheldon Wolin on the Real News Network are just the seminal interviews that every American should hear. I thank you very much for those interviews.
Well, thank you. He's an amazing philosopher.
Oh, I just enjoyed every minute of them. Chris, you have said as a socialist that you have no voice in America. So my main question to you is about this appeal for a mass movement and aligning ourselves with independent parties. That's my main question. But, people have not heard why you are a socialist, how a brilliant man like yourself would come to embrace those principles. That would be valuable if you ever wanted to comment on that. And secondly, Ralph Nader and Noam Chomsky, who I revere as everybody does, they still seem to want to participate in the system where you're much more resolute about how the corporate coup d'etat has taken control and it's over. If you want to comment on that, I'd appreciate that. But my main question to you is, with regards to this crisis of language that you said, go read Democracy Incorporated, which I did. You then suggested reading John Ralston's Saul, Unconscious Civilization, which I did. You get this crisis of language. Even in the interviews with Sheldon Wolin, even just the simple word of revolution is debatable. Now, my question, Chris, is, in a corporate-dominated media that perpetuates this crisis of language, denying the masses a critical view of neoliberalism. You wrote today about Karl Marx was right, and all of the other language that we never hear.
John,
how do we build...
John, excuse me. Your questions are absolutely brilliant. Let Chris answer them. You hang on a bit, because I want to expand a little on a couple of the things that you brought up. So, Chris, would you like to start trying to answer John's questions?
Well, let's start with socialism, because I lived in Europe, in Switzerland, which has probably the best healthcare system in the world, and everyone has access to it. It's actually a private system, but it's heavily regulated by the government. So everybody pays a nominal fee of 300 francs, and if you can't pay that fee, then it's subsidized. I saw in the Scandinavian countries, especially in the 1980s, how they effectively eradicated poverty. Even in Switzerland, there were no homeless. Those who were mentally ill were taken care of. People had pensions. A senior school teacher earned as much as a doctor. It was a sane society. Now, the taxation was heavy. And so it was very hard to be extremely rich in Switzerland, although rich foreigners would come in. But it was a society when I lived there where everyone had a chance, where everyone had access to first-class education, first-class health care, and where the vulnerable, the elderly, the ill, the mentally ill, all were taken care of. And given the resources that we have, there's no excuse.
But Chris, John, this is exactly to the point that John brought up. These are absolutely wonderful things that we should know about, but we don't get to know about it in America.
Right.
I mean, we have Social Security now. Very few people realize that Norman Thomas, the socialist candidate for president in the teens, that was part of his program. And it was introduced to save capitalism in America by FDR's New Deal. People do not know this. The other thing that he brought up, a lot of us, because of the internet, are really well informed, but we are in our own little isolated information islands. We don't congregate and meet with people. There was a time in the 30s and the 40s when there were millions of union workers. Unions were crushed first by Reagan, the air traffic controllers, and by every Republican and Democratic president since. So how do you, first of all, inform people the way you would like to inform them? Then, tougher still, how do you get to organize them when everybody's so, it's a diaspora. I mean, they just don't get together anymore.
Well, that atomization of the population is, as you correctly point out, a huge impediment towards resistance. If you're sitting alone in your room writing furious diatribes against the state on your computer, you're still sitting alone in your room, which is just where they want you. So you're exactly right. And I think that one of the things that disturbed the state about the Occupy movement is that it actually created public space and public dialogue and a public consciousness. And a sense that we're not alone, that there are other people out there with these concerns that are willing to fight for them. But you're exactly right. And the privatization of space. Imagine going into a shopping mall and trying to hold a rally against fracking. there aren't any spaces left, almost, by which we can express dissent. And that's, of course, been done on purpose. You're right that the dismantling of all of those popular mechanisms or organizations or mass movements that, as Howard Zinn points out, created the openings in our democracy. We were built as a closed system that protected a landed aristocracy, white slaveholding, largely slaveholding male class. And then we saw throughout our history struggles, and the labor wars in the United States were the bloodiest in the industrialized world. Hundreds of workers were murdered, often by vigilante groups, gun thugs, the Pinkertons, the Baldwin Felts, the reign of terror against African Americans that went from the end, well, went all through slavery, but then continued after emancipation, all the way up even today, where you're seeing black men and women murdered at a rate of one every 28 hours, and the Washington Post just did a story that said that
Chris, as you so brilliantly pointed out on that, essay, The Pathology of the Rich White Family, that mentality still exists in the 1% that own the corporations that own the country.
Right.
Now, the Indian Revolution was probably the most peaceful because the Indians outnumbered the British by 1,000 to 1. So it's a lot easier. But as Jefferson pointed out, it only takes a handful with a real purpose to start a revolution. So I'm going to take a break now, and after I come back, I'm going to kind of put you on the spot. How far do you think Thoreau's or Jefferson's civil disobedience should go if the United States is dragged into another lying war with Iran, probably initiated by Israel? I'm going to take a break right now, and I have a couple of thoughts on what I think civil disobedience should be, and I'm not sure you would agree because I know you do not like confrontation, even though you've been arrested a number of times. We're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll be back with the one and only Chris Hedges.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer, and this is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knapp, Coast to Coast AM.
Now the dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
I'd like to thank George Knapp, the best host of Coast to Coast, for that terrific unsolicited review of our documentary, The Last Word in the Assassination. You can get it at Amazon, as well as read dozens of other terrific unsolicited reviews, some from some very famous people. Also, while you're there, for just a couple of bucks, you might want to pick up John Barber's Uncensored Facebook, Volume 1, with a terrific interview by Richard Belzer. You can open it any place and find something that'll make you laugh or think. It's sort of chicken soup for the funny bone. But right now, you know, folks, I've interviewed Reagan and Muhammad Ali and all the heavyweight producers and stars in Hollywood over the years. And I must tell you, I have never been as excited or moved or thrilled to be talking to someone as I am with Chris Hedges. He's got a book out again. All of his books are must read. It's called Wages of Rebellion. He's with us right now. And Chris, I want to get to the question I posed before the break, and that's how far would you carry civil disobedience if and when, and it'll probably happen, the United States and Israel go to war against Iran?
I pray that doesn't happen. It's pretty clear that it's what Bibi Netanyahu wants, and he certainly has very strong support, especially within the Republican Party, for that. Although he has strong opposition within the Pentagon that realizes the disaster that it would be.
There were marches, millions of people in New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Chicago and around the world marched against what they obviously felt was an unnecessary and a lying war in Iraq. And it didn't stop anybody going in there. Okay?
Now, you're right.
During the Vietnam War, another illegal war, I remember the protests in the 60s. You were much, much too young. And I must tell you, it was my belief that people voting democratically with their feet at the Chicago Democratic Convention and all around the country. But the saddest story I heard was of a young lady who was trying to stop a train of munitions going into San Diego, and she lay down on the tracks, and they ran over her. It reminded me of the story of that American girl in Palestine who lay down in front of Israeli tanks, and they ran over her. So here's what I would propose, and I would get your reaction to it. Let's say that the Republicans and the liars take us into this war in Iraq, and there are going to be millions of people who are going to be upset by it, knowing it's another lying war, but only a handful would take action. I would propose or suggest, if I were running something like that, like Abby Hoffman did in Chicago, I would pick 500 very dedicated people and tell them to take their cars and drive them on the busiest thoroughfares in New York and Chicago and San Francisco and Los Angeles and abandon their cars on the freeways to bring America to a stop. Would you go along with something like that?
Yeah, I wrote an article for The Nation magazine that said if we go to war with Iran, I will no longer pay any of my income taxes. So I'm with you. I worked in Iran a lot when I was the Middle East Bureau Chief for the New York Times. And what people don't understand is that Iran, unlike southern Lebanon, which the Israelis tried to dominate through the use of saturation bombing and cluster bombs, wow, is a huge country. And many of these sites, the upwards of 1,000 sites that they would target, are in heavily populated areas, often underground. The loss of civilian life, if they actually went after those targets, would run into the tens of thousands. So I think that, coupled with the fact that Iran actually signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, unlike Israel, which surreptitiously or secretly developed a nuclear weapons program, Iran is reacting to the fact that Israel is a nuclear power. Everybody saw that, despite all the rhetoric, nobody wanted to invade North Korea because they had the bomb. And if Iraq had the bomb, they wouldn't have invaded them either. And I think that there's a kind of dark logic. I have no evidence that the Iranians are actually building a weapon. But I should probably not pay my income taxes given Iraq and Afghanistan. But if we start going to war with Iran, I'm sort of finished. Yeah.
Well, the CIA itself says that Iran is not building a bomb.
Yeah, there is no evidence that they're right. There is no evidence that Iran is building a bomb.
I'm going to bring up a name that John from Canada mentioned, and that's Noam Chomsky. I have a lot of Noams books. And when he writes about foreign affairs, I'm a huge fan and devourer of his words. But before I get to my question about him, you are the only person I have ever called on C-SPAN to ask a question. And this was a year ago. I think you were on In Depth. And the question was, again, about another intellectual. His name was Chris Hitchens. Chris Hitchens. Chris Hitchens wrote a book calling, in essence, for the arrest of Henry Kissinger as a war criminal because of what he and Nixon did to Salvador Allende in Chile, okay? Called him a war criminal. And yet, he did not ever, ever do anything but defend what many people think and thought was a war criminal in George Bush or George Cheney lying us into Iraq. And the question I pose to you, because you speak to thousands of people and they devour what you have to say, and they're bright young kids and they're bright old folks. And the question was, in your dealing with people, have you ever come to the conclusion that human beings are not reasoning creatures, but rather creatures of emotions? I mean, Chris Hitchens is he is exposed to the same facts we're all exposed to about Kissinger, who indeed had the CIA murder Allende, and then he had the same facts. We all know that there were lies about weapons of mass destruction and Condoleezza Rice talking about the smoke being that of a nuclear weapon. And because of his emotional prejudices, came to used his intellect to come to an entirely different conclusion. So it seems to me, my feeling is I get a little disheartened because people don't digest the facts. They manipulate them to suit their own beliefs.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, I was a war correspondent for 20 years. War is not a rational enterprise. I've watched whole societies, including the Serbs in Yugoslavia, at a certain point commit willful collective suicide in order to perpetuate a war in the same way that we're essentially committing collective suicide by continuing these wars in the Middle East. You're right. I mean, there's nothing rational about human existence or human nature, and as you correctly point out, with a figure like Christopher Hitchens, they often use their intellect or their reason to justify and defend the irrational. So Hitchens, who you point out condemned Henry Kissinger as a war criminal, becomes best friends with Paul Wolfowitz after 9/11. And it's completely, I mean, it's factually the incongruity of, you know, the verifiable fact that was laid before him, I think is evidence that, you know, that none of us are finally rational, and that most of us, tend to use our intellects to justify often irrational belief systems.
Before I get to Chomsky, what was the driving force that compelled you to write Wages of Rebellion? And what could you tell us, hopefully, I mean, when you spoke to the people on C-SPAN, you just glowed with this hope. And I would like to be able to digest and live with some of that hope, and it's quite difficult. So tell me about Wages of Rebellion.
Well, I had written books kind of looking at the breakdown of capitalist democracy and where we were, death of the liberal class, empire of illusion, the end of literacy, and the triumph of spectacle, and the book before Wages of Rebellion, which was Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, written out of the poorest pockets of the United States, Camden, New Jersey, the coal fields of southern West Virginia, Pine Ridge, South Dakota, these places that have been sacrificed by capitalism, these sacrifice zones where the environment and the people all have been obliterated to feed corporate profit, because now, of course, we've all become part of a sacrifice zone. And this book is different in a sense that I've I'm not making that argument. Now I'm talking about the mechanics of rebellion, what it takes, the kinds of people who do it, how the state responds, and finally, the moral imperative of revolt, that we're called finally to stand up against what Hannah Arendt or Immanuel Kant would call radical evil, not finally for what we can achieve, but for who it allows us to become. So that's the kind of the thesis of the book.
Well, before I get to my question about Chomsky, and hopefully we'll have time because I would love to hear your answer, a number of people like me are really anxious to talk to the Voice of America, and that indeed, Chris, is you. So I'm going to say this right now. There is a fellow in New York named Rob waiting to talk to you. There's another fellow named Rob in Hawaii wants to talk to you, and Anthony from Oregon. So I'm going to ask each one of you, when you get on with Chris, ask him one quick question that he can answer so that I can get you all in before I get my answer about Noam Chomsky. Okay, Rob in New York, we're going to start with you. A quick first question for Chris.
How does he talk about the virtues of socialism in Switzerland and yet neglect the fact to mention even to the audience that it's a place that's 100% white and has 8 million people? I mean, how do you let champagne socialists like that get away with it?
Okay, hold it. Rob, that is a great question. It is 100% white. And when whites riot, they don't steal television sets. I understand that. Okay, thanks for the call, and let Chris answer it. Go ahead,
oh,
Chris.
I lived in Switzerland, as I said, and it is one of the most xenophobic and racist countries I've ever been in, and deeply uncomfortable for that reason. I've also lived in France, which is a deeply xenophobic and racist country, but that what doesn't stop me from admiring the French healthcare system. So I'm hardly here to defend Switzerland, but I am here to say, or France or any other European country, but I am here to say that there are mechanisms of governance which can create systems whereby all of your citizens are taken care of. But there are many aspects of Swiss society that I found deeply distasteful. Yes, and I agree with your caller. I didn't mean in any way to try and run an advertisement for Switzerland.
Well, I'm glad he called because it was a great question and a great answer. So let's go to Rob Kitzel in Hawaii. Again, Rob, one quick question and then let Chris answer it.
Well, thank you very much, John. And thank you for doing this, Chris. I would like to ask a quick question that somebody's brought to my attention, which is about Judicial Watch obtaining declassified documents saying that the West, including the likes of MI6 and the US intelligence agencies, actually were involved in creating ISIS. And is he looking to investigate this further and expose them? Thank you in advance, Chris.
Well, when you brutalize people, as long as we have brutalized the people in Iraq, they become brutal in the same way that the saturation bombing of Cambodia produced Pol Pot. The saturation bombing has produced a group like ISIS. We saw that when they burned the Jordanian pilot in the cage, what they were really doing, because they don't have an air force, is replicating the incineration of their own families by the U.S. Air Force. It was cruder, of course, but morally it was no different. So that, coupled with the fact that Baghdadi moved into the Syrian conflict knowing that he could get money and weapons from countries like Qatar and Saudi Arabia, used those resources to essentially build his organization and turn on competing rebel movements. We are very, very responsible for the emergence of ISIS, without question.
Rob, thanks so much for that call. Now I'm going to go to Anthony in Oregon. Anthony, your question for Chris, please.
Oh, thank you. And good to talk to you, Chris. What do you think about Aaron Swartz's victory against the SOPA bill that was getting run through Congress? Because I see that as a major victory for the Internet community.
Well, it was, but then look what they did to Aaron Swartz. They hounded him until he committed suicide.
That was tragic, yes, but
well,
it was a
but,
good
yes,
start.
But, it sort of explains exactly how vicious the state is.
Yeah, it's hard to win. Well, thanks.
And also, thank you so much for your call, Anthony. Also, Cynthia McKinney, who wanted to audit the Fed and who was one of only one or two people. You know, you're well aware, I guess, when congressmen and senators take their seats, they're not pledging allegiance to the flag, or they're not signing to protect the Constitution. They pledge their support to Israel. And Cynthia McKinney came out against, she just didn't want to sign it. And they waged an absolutely destructive campaign that got her out.
I think they put, that's right, I think they put $8 million in to defeat her?
They put $8 million in to defeat her. So this brings us sort of to the next question. Dennis Hastert was a teacher. He was worth $270,000 when he came to Washington, D.C. to represent the state of Illinois. And after paying $3.5 million to a blackmailer, he still has $13 million left. Chris, how on earth do these people do it? How do they make that kind of money?
It's just legalized bribery. I mean, that's what our system has devolved to, one where money has replaced the vote. We are about to watch Michelle and Barack Obama, once they leave the White House, become multimillionaires many times over, in the same way the Clintons have, because, of course, they have served corporate power, and corporate power will reward them for it. You see all of the donors to the Clinton Foundation. Many of those people have a vested interest in the Keystone Pipeline, in arms deals. It is a thoroughly, completely corrupted system where you know, the consent of the governed is a joke.
You know, it seemed the only time it looked like there might be help for or hope for a third party was when Ross Perot spent his own money. And I remember vividly those debates that he had with Bush and with Clinton, and he would often buy a half an hour of his own time. And what he was trying to explain to America the most was NAFTA. And the reason I sort of loved this guy is I was a great fan of Frank Capra movies and Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And here it looked like this hillbilly, this rich hillbilly, was up there taking on the big boys. And I remember him standing in the middle of the stage. He pointed at Clinton and he said, if you vote for him, he's going to sign NAFTA. You will lose your factories and your jobs. Then he pointed at Bush, and he repeated the same thing. The word was that he got like 22% of the vote, I think, but the word was that he actually bowed up because there were threats against his daughter who was about to be married. But people do not realize Bill Clinton was probably the most dreadful president we have ever had, first of all, with the destruction of our economy with the signing of NAFTA, then the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which prevented Wall Street from taking my home and the homes of thousands of other people, and there was no need for Waco, absolutely no need for Waco, and yet he gets $500,000 for a speaking engagement. Who pays that?
Well, the people he serves, Goldman Sachs and everyone else. I mean, it was Clinton that deregulated the FCC. It was Clinton that destroyed welfare and 70% of the old recipients were children. It was Clinton that passed the Omnibus Crime Bill, which exploded the prison population and the private prison industry. All that came from Clinton. And he did it because he wanted corporate money, and he got it. So by the 1990s, the Democrats had fundraising parity with the Republicans. When Obama ran in 2008, he actually got more. All of that was Bill Clinton, and Obama is in that mold of that, you know, he speaks in that traditional feel-your-pain language of the liberal, but he assiduously, like Bill Clinton, serves corporate power.
Then maybe I can get a quick answer to my question about that I asked you about, wanted to ask you about Noam Chomsky. Is when it comes to foreign affairs, I have seen him twice on C-SPAN, and somebody has asked him about the assassination of John Kennedy. And Noam Chomsky not only avoids it, but he's rude to the questioner, saying it has nothing to do with foreign policy. The murder of John Kennedy had everything to do with foreign policy. Within 24 hours, Lyndon Johnson sent 50,000 troops to Vietnam. So I have this ambivalent feeling about him. I love to read the stuff about foreign affairs, and I cannot understand why he won't take it that one step further.
Well...
Oh, we have to say good. Oh gosh, are you kidding? We have to say good night. Oh gosh. Oh, Chris, email me the answer.
Okay. The only thing I'll say about Noam is he is our greatest intellectual, whatever his faults.
Okay. Well, thank you. And I am going to get. I expected from the publisher a copy of a book. I didn't get it, but I'll go to Barnes & Noble tomorrow to get it. You just send me an autograph in the mail, and I'll paste it in the book. And again. Thank you so much for being here. And then again, please take your wife and your four children to see the water diviner.
We will.
Chris,
thank you, John.
Thank you again very much. Have a wonderful night.
Good night.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.